Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. 10 years ago this week, U.S. and British troops took control of Baghdad. A tank crew helped Iraqis pull down an enormous bronze statue of Saddam Hussein in the center of the capital. The toppling became a symbol of victory over the dictator's regime. The Western military occupation had begun, but chaos soon followed. Today's program focuses on the practice of journalism during the Iraq War, after the foreign troops withdrew, and now, as we mark the 10-year anniversary of the invasion and occupation. But first, World Watch. Our international news summary this week focuses on political leadership. Britain held a special parliamentary session to honor the memory of Margaret Thatcher, who died from a stroke this week. Thatcher was Britain's only female prime minister, and she led the country for 11 years. Malaysia is preparing for the biggest test of the governing party's dominance since the country gained independence from Britain more than 5 decades ago. The prime minister announced on national television last week that he was dissolving parliament. And on Wednesday, Malaysia scheduled national elections for May 5th. In Africa, the son of Kenya's founding president has followed in his footsteps. Uhuru Kenyatta was sworn in Tuesday as the country's new president. The day was proclaimed a national holiday so citizens could follow the ceremony. But there are concerns abroad because Kenyatta is now the second sitting African president to face international criminal court charges. Kenyatta allegedly helped to orchestrate violence that marred Kenya's 2007 presidential election. That's it for World Watch. The invasion of Iraq lasted weeks, but the occupation went on for years. The insurgency was fueled by sectarian conflicts and amplified by terrorist organizations. For journalists, this was by far the deadliest war on record. The New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell covered the invasion and stayed in Baghdad during the long insurgency against the occupation. He's with us today to talk about the dangers he and his colleagues dealt with to report from inside Iraq. Also joining the program is a manager for an organization that promotes press freedom in Iraq. Osama Al-Hababa will bring us up to date on the state of Iraq's media 10 years after the invasion. In a later segment, we'll hear from a foreign correspondent who published a book about Iraq just before the war broke out. Now, Stephen, let's bring us back to the invasion when it broke out, and you joined the mad scramble to get across the border. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, journalism in Iraq under Saddam's time, and I did visit briefly under Saddam's time, was very, very, very tightly controlled. Every foreign journalist operating in Iraq had to have a minder and a driver everywhere they went. So when I came in, it was in the last dying days of Saddam's regime under that system. You know, you came across the border, they sealed your satellite phone with wax, they took you straight to the information ministry where it was unsealed, and you were put in the hotel where Saddam put all the journalists. So it was very, very, very tightly controlled. Within a few days, that started to break down mm-hmm. as the regime crumbled. And then by April, I remember the day, April the 9th, right. Reports came in that you know, they were looting what was then called Saddam City, a district of Baghdad, and we all ran out to cover it, and nobody took fixers and drivers. And from then on, it was chaotic and increasingly dangerous. You could operate more freely than mm-hmm. before, but there was a lot of danger there. I would point out, much more so for Iraqi journalists than for foreigners.
Right. Osama, what was your understanding of, after speaking with Iraqi journalists, what it was like in those early days?
Well, I mean, as Stephen said, before the fall of Saddam, and it was not only the foreign correspondents were controlled, but also the local journalists, the Iraqi journalists. And there were only five newspapers, and all related to the government. So every single word you write is controlled and supervised by Saddam and his supervisors and consultants.
And
so everything was controlled, I mean, before the war.
Right. And Stephen, you decided not to become an embedded reporter. Can you briefly explain that decision?
Well, it wasn't really a decision. It wasn't my decision. And the American military brought a group of journalists up from Kuwait during the invasion, and they rolled with the invasion. Some were formally embedded, you know, in armored cars, in uniform, and so on, and some were what they called unilaterals. But basically, they were still under the umbrella. They were following in their own cars, but following the military caravan up north. And then there was a third category of reporters, completely unembedded, totally outside the American military, no accreditation, nothing. We just operated in Baghdad, roamed around on our own steam, Iraqi cars, Iraqi drivers, no. In the early days, we didn't have anyone armed with us. But as 2004 went into 2005, 2006, 2007, many journalists carried, you had to take armed guards. You couldn't move around. Without mostly Iraqis, to drive around with obviously huge Western guards carrying bulletproof jackets and machine guns would have just been pointing a giant finger to yourself, saying right. "Foreigner here, kidnap us."
And Osama, was it similar for the Iraqi journalists? As far as did they have to somewhat? Become embedded with the existing regime to cover this?
Well, I mean, most of the journalists, the foreign journalists coming to Iraq were embedded, as Stephen says, but I mean, how objective, how clear, how factual you can cover a war when you are embedded, that's question. So you will be covering the war from the point of view of the occupier or from the forces you are embedded with.
Okay, let's talk about then, it was a fairly short invasion before the Western forces took control of the country. What was it like in the early days when there was actually, when the occupiers were in charge? Stephen, can you start off?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I think Osama is absolutely right when he says that there was a big question mark over much of the reporting that came in from embedding. And I'm sure he'd agree with me that as soon as the invasion happened and new papers sprang up, in a different way, that was also true of much of the Iraqi reporting, because many of the papers that had the new newspapers and so on and so forth that were set up with the help of, set up by Iraqi political parties and powerful patrons. So you had a situation in which, unless you really knew what was going on, unless you were there and trying to and knew what was going on the ground, you had embedded Western reporters rolling around with American military units. Most of them didn't speak Arabic. They could only go where the military said they could go, and it wasn't safe to go many other places. So that it was a very narrow perspective. And on the Iraqi side, you know, you really had to factor in, well, this is a newspaper that's reporting this, but it's owned by this billionaire or this political party or this. So it was very difficult to navigate between the agendas and the limitations on reporting. It was easier to operate in 2003, 2004. Journalists, unembedded, could roll around. You know, you could drive up when Saddam Hussein's sons were killed in mid-2003. Everybody just jumped in cars and drove up to Mosul and reported it. You didn't go with the military. You didn't go with Iraqis. We just drove up there. When Saddam himself was captured in December 2003, we jumped in a car and rolled up to Tikrit and just spoke to people up there. You could do that. Increasingly, that became less possible.
Yes, I mean, I do agree that the first, let's say, in 2004, 3, 4, and 5, I mean, those 2 years after the war, will the Iraqi press in general enjoy this kind of freedom they got? But it was a part of the chaos sweeping into the country. I mean, it was a chaotic situation for the media in Iraq. And the Iraqi media, which started in those years, was either controlled by the militias, parties, or rich businessmen from Iraq and around the country. I mean, so you had around 850 newspapers in Iraq in 2004, while during Saddam there were only 5 newspapers. So, I mean, this huge jump from 5 to 850, that's,
yeah.
I mean, do Iraq market, or do the Iraqi market can absorb those newspapers? But it was all of them, I mean, with either political or economical agendas, but mainly political agendas.
And I would have to say that I think I certainly saw that the American military and the civilian authorities that were set up on the back of it had great difficulty adjusting to a different culture of media there. I mean, you got executives coming in from Washington and just throwing around terms that are a part of American culture, part of everybody's institutional knowledge. That's on the record, that's off the record, that's deep background, that's background. You try saying that to somebody who has no idea really what those terms mean, and frankly regards it as an occupation force anyway.
Right.
And there were really all sorts of I distinctly remember early press conferences where, you know, we'd all trek into the green zone where all these generals and politicians were, and they'd give a press conference and they'd say, you know, that bit's off the record, that bit's on the record, and the Iraqis would go off and write everything and the Western press would stick to it, and then you'd look stupid because you'd try to abide by some rules. So basically the rules were incredibly artificial and just didn't map onto a whole different template that was being set up from scratch in Iraq, whereas Osama quite rightly says it was chaos, and people were struggling to find out with a new way of working.
Right. I was working for Radio Free Europe at the time in Prague, and our sister station set up a television network inside Iraq, and I don't think it really ever gained the trust of the Iraqis. So I think Osama, were people kind of just trying to figure out what was legitimate news?
When you have having those 850 newspapers and so many satellites, so people were not actually trusting the local, so they were leaning on watching the Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and all the pan-Arab satellite televisions. So that, I mean, the information would come from there, and they would hope that it's real, the actual and the factual news they are getting. But I would like to go back to the Americans coming to Iraq. The Americans had spent $500 million from 2003 to 2006 in projects to develop the media of Iraq. And actually those money was had harmed the Iraqi independent media than really benefiting them. I mean, I could not see, working in Iraq so many years, I could not see that those $500 million spent on Iraqi media development had resulted in anything. In the contrary, actually, they resulted in consolidating the Shia and the pro-government media network in Iraq and the media outlets like Al-Sabah and the Iraqiya television.
Right.
If
go ahead, Steve.
Osama's absolutely right about Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, and I'll give you 2 concrete examples.
Okay.
It's really common sense. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, wealthy organizations that existed before the Iraq War. So when Iraq suddenly became a new market, they moved into it. They had the existing broadcasting structure all set up, correspondents, editors, et cetera, and they just moved in, much as the BBC or NBC could move into a new English-speaking market very quickly and provide highly professional structured news, whereas the startups were obviously couldn't begin to compete with their level of knowledge and experience and wealth. But they brought their own agendas. I mean, I remember very, very clearly in 2003 when the mass graves started to appear in Iraq. I mean, everybody was focusing on the chaos and so on and so forth, but with the collapse of Saddam's regime, you could suddenly find where he'd buried all his victims. And there was real anger among some Iraqis that one or more of those pan-Arab channels would not cover any discoveries of mass graves, because that channel apparently seemed to think that it was a legitimization of the invasion. You know, to point out that mass graves had been discovered meant that Saddam was bad, meant that, in a sense you were suggesting that, that the American invasion was okay, so they just didn't cover it at all. And they didn't. But I met a lot of Iraqis who were absolutely furious. Mm-hmm. The tens and twenties, and in one case I saw 2,000 bodies in one mass grave, weren't being covered. There were lots of agendas there. I think one of the most moving quotes I ever had in Iraq, the one that really sticks with me, was in a very poor family where the mother of the family had died because she was a laundry woman for the Americans up at a base near Fallujah. It's one of the very first executions of Iraqi contractors, in a sense. Oh, this is a very poor woman. And you know, I said to her son, well, how do you feel? You know, you've got this new country, all these new rules, you've got hundreds of newspapers, dozens of satellite stations. And he just looked at me and he said, yeah, we have these new freedoms. I have hundreds of newspapers and dozens of satellite channels, and all of them tell me my mother is dead.
Right.
Which kind of brought it home, you know, that there's abstract freedoms and that there was real solid, concrete things going on there.
Yeah, a lot of death and destruction. Stephen, tell me about the on the dining room table of the New York Times Bureau. I understand there was a sort of a symbol of what was happening in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, by far the majority of Western journalists did not live in the green zone. I never spent a night in the green zone. Most of us had our bureaus outside in the real Baghdad, if you like. We had to go in to the green zone to speak to generals and so on. But there were risks obviously associated with that, and one was that if a car bomb went off nearby or if there was an attack on the compound, you know, you were at real risk. And one day there was a car truck bomb near one of the hotels, and a part of the engine just blew up in the air across two or three gardens and landed in our garden.
Mm-hmm.
And the wreckage, the huge bit of hot metal that landed, once it cooled down, obviously, was just put beside the dining room table in the bureau. It was a real constant reminder to everyone there, and that was its purpose. Was that nothing is safe, nowhere is safe. High walls do not protect you. There's real present danger everywhere.
Osama, can you talk about?
Yes, I would like to comment. I mean, I do agree with Stephen saying that. The Pan Arab television stations did not cover those mass graves and this. I mean, all the television stations, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, and the others, Al Alam, the Iranian. They had their own agendas. They had their own political agendas. And now what's happening on the ground, I can see that it's some kind of a media war between the countries around. I mean, Saudi, Kuwait, Iran, Turkey. And this media war is actually the reason of the divisions now, the chaotic divisions of between the Iraqis themselves, I mean, the Sunni and the Shia.
Right. Yeah. Let's move on to the more present day. What did the Stephen? And I'll go. You go first because I know that Osama has a lot to say about this. What did the withdrawal of foreign troops from Iraq mean for the journalists working inside the country, both foreign and domestic?
Well, I think we all realized there were many problems associated with the whole embedding phenomenon. It basically every time I went back home, people would say, "Oh, do you ever leave the green zone?" And you know, you'd beat your head in frustration, and then you just realize that basically that's what had been created by the first few years of war. Nobody knew what was an embedded report, what wasn't. As the Americans pulled out, obviously there was less and less embedding to do, and the country was dangerous. So there was it was very, very difficult to report on the ground for a while. We're talking, say, 2008-09 or so. Mm-hmm. As it became safer, as the Iraqi security forces just grew in number and grew and grew and grew, and there were so many of them, they saturated everywhere. It was safer to move around, but they put incredible restrictions on what you could and couldn't report.
Mm-hmm.
Photographers, it almost became pointless for a photographer to go to Iraq because if there was an explosion, and there were many, the police would just hold you back. They would push your camera down. They wouldn't let you photograph dead bodies. They wouldn't let you photograph car damage. They just didn't want that image of Iraq out.
Right.
And they were very, very tight on it. And I know this was true for the Iraqi journalists as much as for Westerners. So you could move around, but actually it became harder to work. And obviously, as always, you had attacks on Iraqi journalists,
right,
particularly. reprisals. People didn't like what they saw. Militias, insurgent groups, angry politicians. They would take it out on the journalists, and many, many have died.
In an opinion piece in the Washington Post that marked the 10-year anniversary, Iraq's prime minister said the overwhelming majority of Iraqis agree that they are better off today than under Saddam's brutal dictatorship. But Osama, are journalists inside Iraq better off now?
I would say that since the withdrawal of the Americans, that was December 11th, we could experience an increase in the violations and the attacks against journalists. Many of the Sunni journalists actually are fleeing Baghdad, going to KRG, that's the Kurdistan region, because it's safer for Sunni journalists to operate from Kurdistan. And the funny story actually I've heard, I just came last week from Iraq, it was a Kurdish journalist who was jailed by Saddam and tortured by Saddam, telling me that it was safer to work mm-hmm. as a journalist under Saddam, because you could know, you know that who will punish you, who will try to shoot you or to try to kill you. Now you don't know from where the bomb is coming, from where the shooting is coming.
Stephen, what's your opinion on
Certainly many of my Iraqi colleagues at the New York Times and the London Times I worked before that have now left the country and moved to America. There's no question but that they feel that their profession is dangerous and that their country is dangerous. One of my former colleagues did actually work as a journalist under Saddam and said that, that particular journalist said that they knew that you could even make criticisms of certain government members, but you couldn't touch Saddam's family. That was a complete red line. However, I wouldn't be too rosy-tinted about Saddam's time. The British journalist Farzad Bazoft was executed by Saddam on spurious charges that he was a spy. It's just no proper trial, just killed outright. I mean, Saddam was very, very very brutal, and he controlled journalists in such a way that they just never crossed the line. I do take Osama's point that now nobody knows where the red lines are. Every militia, every insurgent group draws their own red line and takes reprisals if they feel that line has been crossed. It's a very confusing, very dangerous situation.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. So, Stephen and Osama, thank you so much for providing insight about the media in Iraq, and hope conditions improve there.
Thanks
for joining us.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Now, before we move on to our next segment, I want to point out that our website this week features articles on the evolution of Iraq's media, as well as a chart of journalists who've been killed in Iraq. You can listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts from the website globaljournalist.org. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GlobalJorn. Reese Ehrlich has been writing about international affairs for about 40 years now, and he's the author of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, a book that came out just shortly before the invasion of Iraq. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Reese, I read that you and the book's co-author spoke this week at an event in Colorado with an intriguing title, Who Won the Iraq War? So tell us now that we've had 10 years to reflect on the invasion. What's your short answer on that?
Well, I'll give you a hint. It wasn't the United States. After over $1 trillion, tens of thousands of deaths, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths, and billions of dollars in supposed aid and so on, the Iranian government has more influence in Baghdad today than the U.S. The U.S. troops, military bases are not there. The troops are not there. By pretty much any standard, the Iraq War was a waste, and the U.S. didn't win.
And have there been improvements in the coverage of the region?
Well, I would argue no. Media coverage was a disaster, particularly in the lead-up to the war, where all the major media agreed that there were weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was an immediate threat, et cetera, all of which turned out not to be true. And we're now seeing that replayed with Iran. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. It's years away from being able to develop weapons and deliver them. And yet we're told to be very, very afraid, and there has to be crippling sanctions and perhaps a military intervention. It's a replay of the Iraq War misinformation.
Right. And you've since then you've written a book about Iran, and you've written about dictators, and now you're writing about Syria's civil war. That civil war and the revolutions in Libya and Egypt have a impact on media dynamics in the rest of the region?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I've been writing about media coverage for many, many years now. And when a crisis first breaks out, where it's actually the time when we get the best coverage. The popular uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt happened with nobody had predicted them. And the media, along with the U.S. government and everybody else, was scrambling to figure out what was going on. And that's when I think we got some of the most interesting coverage, the most dynamic, and exploring not only what's going on with the governments, but what's going on with the trade unions, what's going on with the student movements, what's going on with the Islamic movements. But as the crisis, as Washington kind of figures out what stand it's going to take, unfortunately, the major media tend to use that as their prism on which to report it.
Okay, and just very briefly, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing a functioning civil society today in Iraq?
In Iraq? Well, I think clearly the many years of militarization, the UN sanctions, the civil war, all make it anybody who's running the government in Iraq is going to be have a very difficult time. But I think the number one issue is the failure of the current government to be all-inclusive, to include factions and political parties from the Sunni, from the Kurd, and from other communities, and it's focused on kind of a sector of the Shia, and that's made it very difficult to have a functioning parliamentary system.
Okay. Well, Reese, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today were New York Times reporter Stephen Farrell, Osama Al-Hababa, the Iraq Program Manager for International Media Support, and Reese Ehrlich, author of Target Iraq. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan. Audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Mikkel Christensen was our lead producer, with help from Laura Belahiva, Ben Nadler, and Kelly Moffitt. Just ahead is Free Press Watch. And please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Adam Aiton. This week's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Al Jazeera, and Reporters Without Borders. The government of Cameroon banned three news organizations indefinitely and suspended seven journalists from work April 3rd after they reported on multiple killings in the country. Cameroon's National Communications Council, which was granted new regulatory power in 2012, accused the news programs of showing long segments of, quote, violent and indecent images. In fact, these stations had been covering the rash of gruesome murders that gripped the country this March. The stations highlighted ritual killings, organ trafficking, and the government's inability to stop the violence. Nearly 200,000 Bangladeshi demonstrators flooded the streets of the capital April 6th to demand anti-blasphemy laws that would allow the death penalty for bloggers who insult Islam. A string of protests and counter-protests have rocked Bangladesh since February, when the government sentenced a leader of an Islamic political party to death. More than 70 people have died in the protest. In an attempt to quell the violence, the government has blocked a handful of websites and blogs that it claims insult Islam. A court in the United Arab Emirates sentenced the son of a criminal defendant to 10 months in jail for tweeting about his father's trial. Abdullah Al-Hadidi live-tweeted the proceedings from inside the Abu Dhabi courtroom, where the UAE is trying 94 Islamists, the largest mass trial in the Arab state's history. Observers and foreign media were not allowed to attend this trial. The government claims the 94 defendants have ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and were attempting to seize power. For more information on these stories and other events concerning press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Adam Aiton. We'll see you next week.